Welcome to Honey and the Hex. We're a sibling duo exploring the origins, traditions, and intersections of folklore and where they lie today.
We've always been drawn to witchcraft and exploring our roots, so each episode will take you through our learnings of myths, magic, and mystery in English and Scottish folklore.
It was spring of 1998 when John Lorimer and his brother-in-law were out catching shrimps and unearthed a Bronze Age axe head in the sand. As an amateur archaeologist, Lorimer was fascinated and began to visit the site regularly, eventually discovering a solo upside-down tree stump on the beach. But how long had this stump been here? And what on earth could it have been used for? Today, join us on the water as we plunge into the mystery of Sea Henge.
We say join us on the water quite literally today as we are recording on the boat pod in Little Venice.
Which is so ideal. I literally feel like I'm plunged into the water.
It's amazing. We've got full on circular boat windows. The aesthetic is perfect.
And natural light for once in our
lives. Exactly.
Okay, so let's get into it. Sea Henge, named appropriately by the media as it resembles Stonehenge, was a 4,000-year-old Bronze Age timber discovered in 1998 on Home Beach in Norfolk. It isn't actually a henge, so to speak, as a henge is usually a circle of stones or timber which has an earthenwork to it. So that would be like a mound or a trench or something like that. But anyway, great name. It was also known as Home One, but I think we'll just stick to Sea Henge.
And we actually hadn't heard of Sea Henge before. I went to an exhibition at the British Museum a few weeks ago now. The exhibition was quite disappointing, to be honest. And 18 quid, that's not cheap. Classic British Museum.
I remember when you left, I was like, oh, I'm definitely going to book a ticket. And you were like, well,
not really sure.
Not much point because there wasn't really much to it.
It was mostly artifacts and the construction of Stonehenge, which is obviously really interesting.
But that's still there as well, so you can just go see it, no?
Yeah. The thing that I feel so many people are drawn to is the mythology, the folklore of it, and they didn't have any segment on that. So yeah, I was just a bit disappointed. But a positive that came out of it is I learned about Sea Henge for the first time, and they actually had part of Sea Henge there. And it really took me aback. That was the one thing that I left, and it stayed in my mind. And then I said to Tansy, I was like, let's do an episode on Sea Henge because, yeah, we didn't know about it.
Yeah, and here we are 2 weeks later in the water talking about Sea Henge. I actually love it.
So it was an enormous tree stump which had been buried upside down with the roots facing upwards.
Roots the house down. Sorry.
Roots the house down.
Also, I know you said enormous, but just to grill that in, it was huge.
Mm. And surrounding the stump were 55 timber posts. These formed a circular enclosure. It was around 18 feet long and 15 feet wide, and it was believed at one point the posts stood about 10 feet tall. So you can imagine the speculation of what this was and what it was all about when it was discovered. No one really knows exactly what the site was used for, but of course, there are theories.
So if we get into its construction, it was constructed during the early Bronze Age using at least 50 different Bronze Age axes, sculpting the timber into different shapes and sizes. Pretty impressive, especially considering that this was during a time when archaeologists believed that the bronze tools were pretty new and rare. So we're talking 2049 BCE, a really fucking long time ago. And it was also originally built on a salt marsh, but over the centuries became a freshwater wetland. Also, I love that it was an amateur archaeologist, John Lorimer, that discovered Sea Henge. Like, imagine you're just out on the beach trying to catch some scampi for your dinner and you unearth an ancient monument that will be talked about forevermore.
And then I guess it sucks because he had to hand it over to professionals.
Professionals.
Which obviously is fair, but also a bit sad for him because he's discovered this thing and he's like, oh, I've got to pass this over. Hope they kept him on the excavation.
I doubt it. Have you seen the dig?
I actually haven't seen the dig.
Okay, no spoilers.
Worth watching?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll put it on the list. So Lorimer contacted the Castle Museum. He'd also contacted them when they found the original axe head, so before the tree stump was unearthed. As wave erosion continued, it slowly exposed the surrounding timbers. This is when it was realised that it was an intentional human construction.
And here began a huge archaeological excavation, which due to the sea was very difficult as the site only emerged for a few hours of the day during the low tide. But by 1999, a tree sample came back indicating that it was Bronze Age. And they literally, I think with this form of, what's it called, dendrochronology with tree samples, you can find out the exact, you can find out the season. So this was spring. It was constructed spring 2049 BC.
The skill that takes to actually be able to
it's like the rings when you like when you get the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh yeah,
they're just called chainsaws, aren't they?
You're such a goth.
All I do is watch horror all day. So they obviously slice it through and then you can see like the circles. And somehow, look, I'm not a tree person. Well, I'm a tree person, but I'm not a tree surgeon.
Tree hugger, but not a surgeon. Here begins the controversy.
Drama!
As media interest grew, aptly naming the site Seahenge, there was huge resistance from New Age and neo-pagan movements who believed they had, and I quote, a kind of spiritual ownership of the circle.
Fair enough.
They protested daily that if the structure was removed, it was an insult to the religious beliefs of those who built it as an altar.
Which is so true, because to think that the people who constructed this to then have it taken away from its place of creation. Yeah. That's just something that they would never imagine. This was everything to them. It was their altar. But the issue was that if the site was not removed from the beach, now it was exposed, it would continue to erode and eventually wash out to sea. But then other people argued. Actually, I saw a YouTube interview with a protester named Crow. What a great name. Mm. And it said, well, it would be reclaimed by the sea. With former fisherman and parish councilman Jeff Needham stating, something about this site, when you see it in its natural surroundings, to take it out would mean nothing. It's broken what it means.
The protesters managed to team up with the Council of British Druid Orders to receive donations and assistance. The Druids had a very strong connection to Seahenge and other Bronze Age sites. They deem these essential to their religious beliefs and practices.
Yeah. So these are the people that, you know, celebrate at Stonehenge every year. They, mm-hmm. you know, they put on all these different events and this is really strong to their beliefs. The Druids knew that they would need a bit more help. So they called upon pagan icon Buster Nolan to assist.
Which is also an amazing name.
Actually, I looked at Buster Nolan's Facebook page, cheeky little stalk. And as of today, it says, Buster Nolan, tree campaigner, cannabis/hemp candidate, proto-druid, poet, and seeker of the truth.
Seeker of the truth.
Please at us, Buster, because we want to be friends.
Yeah, he does sound like a G, to be fair.
There's our tree surgeon, tree hugger.
English Heritage continue to argue that the elements would destroy the monument anyway, and that we need to preserve it for future generations. They had no interest in leaving Seahenge in situ. Well, I disagree. I think I disagree because...
It's a hard one.
The majority of the time, I believe that you should leave things where you found them. And actually, especially with something like this, I understand, yeah, it will be taken off into the sea. Mm-hmm. But...
Then maybe that's where it belongs.
Yeah, I don't think
it
should be.
And also, it could have re-emerged, you know, in another 1,000 years. And then at least we've got this podcast to look back on and they can tell you all about it. It's hard because obviously the locals and like visitors, they were really respectful to the site and everyone just wanted to appreciate it. And no one could have imagined that it would be, you know, dragged away from its place of creation.
Yeah, but they like, just didn't think that was an option.
Yeah, because it was just there, part of their lives. But then I guess they also wouldn't have thought that it would be submerged in water eventually and then... I mean, it's really hard, isn't it? And also, if you don't, it would be taken away by the sea and then no one would ever see it. Oh, and wait. You saw it at British Museum.
That's true. But I just think that you can bring things to life without them being in a museum because leave things alone, leave them there where they were supposed to be and where they belong. And if even if I went to this exhibition and I saw a massive sort of hologram of it or a, you know, a projection, there's so much that you can do.
Beautiful photo exhibition.
Well, exactly.
And of Buster Nolan, like with one of the timber posts.
There's so many things that you can do to bring something to life and you can do storytelling that doesn't rely on actually physically having it there. They could have actually, to be fair, at the British Museum, the exhibition I went to, it was really gorgeous. They had the waves and they had it lit up. But they could have done that with a photograph. I don't believe.
They could have replicated it. They do that all the time. So
that's so true.
I mean, resin everywhere. It's always resin everywhere. And for a clumsy cancer like myself, resin is a disaster.
Fair.
It's hard because also the more that English Heritage argued, they would also try and, you know, get on other groups like the Norfolk Wildlife Trust. It was noted that all the visitors had affected the wildlife, particularly the migratory seabirds. So the Norfolk Wildlife Trust asked everyone to stay away. But I mean, that was never going to happen. But then obviously you've got English Heritage arguing that, you know, you're affecting the wildlife, you're doing this. But they basically told the locals that they were going to do a full excavation. And there was really nothing the locals could do about it. So they were like set in their ways. They were going to like excavate fully.
Right, yeah.
Which is like, but they would put on all these meetings with the locals, like, so the press would think, oh, you know, they're really trying their best, but they had no intention of leaving it
there.
Yeah,
it was all optics.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I'm now going to read an article from The Independent in 1999, as it really encapsulates the time. And this is after English Heritage and Norfolk Archaeological Unit had succeeded in the plans to go ahead with the full excavation. Because to be fair, the pagans did, and the neo-pagans and the movements, they did delay the excavation.
Yeah.
So, but you know, once you've got the power of that, you're just like, well, we know how exhausting that is. The talking is over. Chanting and holding hands fail to bring peace. So at low tide tomorrow, a lonely Norfolk beach will host the latest confirmation between druids, eco-warriors and the law. Fortified with drums, poems and a didgeridoo, the barefoot protesters will attempt to stop archaeologists removing what they call Sea Henge, a 4,000-year-old tree circle half buried in the sand a mile from the village of home next to the sea. They have already managed to halt the work once by braving the rising North Sea and chill winds to occupy the Bronze Age relic on the 15th of June. A week later, there were secret talks with officials conducted under druidic rules, but the compromise agreed then has now been rejected by some of the protesters, continuing with their direct action. They've formed an alliance with local businesses and residents who accuse English Heritage of riding roughshod over public opinion. The fight is over a ring of 54 split oak timbers, each a metre high, encircling an upturned oak tree with roots that fan out like fingers. It is thought to have been an altar where the dead were helped on their way back to the afterlife. At only 20 feet across, Sea Henge is far smaller than its stone namesake. It was spotted late last year by a man walking on the beach at low tide. Mark Brennand of Norfolk County Council's Archaeological Unit, who went to inspect it, found the site eerie and profoundly moving. The handful of people who trekked out along the beach for the summer solstice last week found it less inspiring. The excavation had been abandoned with half the circle missing and nylon sandbags piled around the outside. But Philip Walker, Inspector of Ancient Monuments for English Heritage, said the site was unparalleled in Britain and, as far as I know, anywhere else in the world. The peat beds that preserved the circle for four millennia had eroded, he said, and would soon be claimed by the sea. The timbers would be preserved and analysed for invaluable information on Bronze Age life before being returned to a safer site on land.
Hmm.
So now it's in like Norfolk Museum, yeah. King's Lynn Museum.
On long-term loan.
Give it back.
I think it's quite sad the way that it, I can imagine it was quite painful for the locals to see that. Mm-hmm. And coming across something that was so profoundly moving and then seeing it turned into a construction site, that must have felt like it was taking all of the magic out of it.
Exactly. And also the locals, they kind of already knew about Sea Henge. They kind of knew it existed. It was part of local legend and folklore, as it appeared as a ghostly, sometimes there, sometimes not site. Yeah. Because, I mean, if you're there, if that's your place, you walk your dogs there, you know, sometimes at low tide, you're like, oh, what is that?
Wow. So people were seeing it and it was sort of a legend, but no one had actually clarified what it was.
Exactly, until John Lorimer was there. And actually, I think it was due to, there was a massive storm in 1998, so that really uncovered it. But then because of that, the locals were really protective over it and they didn't want it to be removed. Look, this affects them directly. Like, archaeologists can't just claim everything as their own. Like, it should be up to the locals.
Also, would it not have been really good tourist attraction as well, which brings in a lot of business?
And that's also what the locals argued. So as Seahenge was fully excavated, another site came up, which they called Home 2. So this was, I'm not sure how far it was from the original site, but they left this one alone and they called it Home 2. So I think by English Heritage, you're like, oh, well, you know, we left Home 2, which is a much smaller version, but at least
we gave you this.
We gave you this, girl. So so that is still there. But like even today, like it's quite iconic because there's a whole Seahenge section. I don't know if this is a PlayStation term. A whole Seahenge section in Assassin's Creed. Do you know what that is?
No.
So that's like a PlayStation thing, but it does look quite cool, to be honest.
Wait, so there's what? There is a Seahenge section?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And then I asked my boyfriend this morning, I said, have you got Assassin's Creed? And he said, yes. And I said, can you play until you get to this? And he said, that'll be 40 hours. And I said, you've got two. But if he does, I'll post it on our Instagram.
Yeah, I need to see that.
So that is a great way to spread the folklore.
Yeah, why not?
As we mentioned before, it is believed that the monument was used as an altar, but it also could have been used for ancient burial practices. One belief was regarding the placement of the tree. As it was buried upside down, roots facing up, it is thought that dead bodies could have been placed on the roots of the trees so animals could help themselves.
Sustainable.
Yeah. This is otherwise known as a mortuary enclosure, and that's for the use of excavation, which is also known as defleshing.
It's the removal of flesh and organs from the dead prior to burial. This can also be done by leaving the body exposed to the elements to just, you know, do its thing.
Erode me.
Or also by hand, so like a Bronze Age Sweeney Todd.
Love it. Chop, chop, chop.
Choppity, chop, chop. Gross.
Seahenge sometime. Sorry.
Nice.
Oh, gosh. I feel like I'm going to get chop, chop, chopped. Like, well, I don't know why.
I have thought about it. Thanks for listening to this episode, and thank you, The Boat Pod, for having us. If you're looking for a recording space, we highly recommend hiring out these studios. Follow them at The Boat Pod on Insta and find more information on their website. It's been so fun, hasn't it?
It's been so good. I never want to get off this boat.
We're coming back.
You can support Henny and the Hex by clicking follow on whichever platform you're listening on, or we'd love it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and connect with us on our socials at Henny and the Hex.
You can also support us by buying us a brew on Ko-fi. That's ko-fi.com/honeyinthehex.
Until next time, Coven.